It's time for Caffeinated Comics, a lively discussion and debate on comics, film, television, and collectibles, all fueled by the magic of Frappuccinos. Caffeinated Comics is sponsored by Chimeras Comics. Chimeras is your one stop for comic books, graphic novels, hero clicks, Magic the Gathering, and more. Explore the fantastic at Chimeras Comics. And now, here's your hosts, John and Steven.
Hi, everybody. This is Caffeinated Comics, and I'm your host, John Clark. Bit of a different show this week. Recently, Star Trek had a huge convention in Las Vegas. Gigantic convention. The entire Next Generation cast was there. The Deep Space Nine cast was there. Kate Mulgrew was there. William Shatner was there. You know who else was there? Bill Monroe. Bill went for the entire weekend, and so he called in to give a report on Skype. Turned out there was so much that happened that weekend that we just kept talking and talking and talking, and it's going to be the whole show. So here's an hour with Bill Monroe talking about Star Trek and Las Vegas.
All right, Bill, I know you've been to Vegas many, many times, but how was this trip different?
This trip was different because I didn't have to get up at 7 in the morning. And let me tell you, Vegas is a very different kind of place when you're not getting up at 7 in the morning to go to work.
I think the only people who are up at 7 in the morning are the people that didn't go to bed.
Yeah, or those of us who are about to go work a trade show floor. Let me tell you, CES is not nearly as much fun as it sounds in the media. But fortunately, this time I didn't have to go to work. It was more like I had to, you know, sort of report for duty on the bridge. Because I got to go there for the Star Trek convention, the big creation official Star Trek convention that just sort of takes over the Rio for an extended weekend, and it was pretty awesome.
Now, was this bigger than when the Star Trek experience used to be in the Hilton?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the Star Trek experience in the Hilton, that was all about a curated museum and the rides and the very polished type of thing. At the Rio, this is just a conference. So it was 10,000 people taking over a ballroom with very minimal decorations. I mean, it's a great show, but they really don't spend much on the decorations or the signage or things like that. And in another ballroom, which was just a merch room. And so basically, the way this conference was set up was there were two different presentation rooms. There was usually the primary one and the secondary one. And then there was the merch room, and that was where everything was centered around. And they used a couple of other spaces for some of the autograph signings and some of the really cool autographs we got to get and doing some things like that. But unlike the Hilton Star Trek experience, which is that curated sort of entertainment thing, this was more, just giving, you know, more definitely more conference-oriented, more ephemeral, for lack of a better term, where you come in and you see the presentations, and then you go see the other presentations, and then you go buy stuff, and then you go start peeling off 20s for autographs with TNG cast members and doing a lot of those kinds of things. It's one of those things where everybody is you're sort of there as with a couple of folks and just sort of going through it as individuals too. So it doesn't have the same broad interactive community element you get at some other conferences and shows, which was really interesting. But one of the really cool things I liked about this show too is that when we bought our tickets, we got assigned seating. Now, this is one of those ways I know I am getting older, because I was really excited at the idea of having an assigned seat throughout the entire show that I could know was always mine and I could always get a seat, damn it.
And as you're saying, with two presentation rooms, so you're saying there were only really two panels going on at any given time?
Exactly. And it was usually, you know, the main... And the secondary room wasn't even used very much. So, you know, unlike, you know, a lot of, you know, anytime you got a South by Southwest where you've got to choose between like 50 different things to do at once, you really didn't have that at the Star Trek convention. So you were able to bring a lot more people into the room at once, which was nice. It made it simpler. You had to make fewer choices. The secondary room would be more like things like some set designers or a panel discussion about the historical analogies in Star Trek or whatever, going in and watching a makeup demonstration as they apply, I think it was the Kaler makeup to the actress who played Alexander's mother from Star Trek, from TNG.
Susie Plaxton.
Susie Plaxton, who, of course, a lot of people know her now as playing Marshall's mother on How I Met Your Mother.
Right, yeah. I always remember her. She's in Wag the Dog.
Yeah, she's done everything. And apparently she's also a musician who does really strange music. Not the strangest of any of the Star Trek characters Star Trek actors by far, but definitely sort of strange. She is a character in and of herself. And then after she put on the Klingon makeup, she goes and does a little monologue as her character. So that was kind of interesting. But that was more secondary room stuff as opposed to the main room where you got to see everything from George Takei giving his talk, where he spends the first 15 minutes talking about trying to get encouraging people to go sign the petition to get the Winter Olympics relocated away from Sochi, Russia, due to the Russian government's new crackdown on homosexuality, and then transitioning into and getting to see presentations where, you know, they do panel discussions of cast members from different shows. Some actors got their own stage time. Some did a duo. And one of the most, and you got to see some really interesting ones. So we got to see Gates McFadden and LeVar Burton on stage talking to one another. We got to see, and of course, Jonathan Frakes walks out in the middle of their presentation to go talk to them, because he was on a panel with Marina Sirtis, and he said that if he didn't come out to interrupt their panel, there was no way he would get a word in edgewise once Marina was on stage. And then, of course, Brett Spiner just walks across the stage for no apparent reason.
The thing about TNG now that they're all middle-aged is they're not only they're very comfortable with themselves, which wasn't really the case when it was running. There was that constant comparison to the original series.
Sure.
But now they just like each other, and they like to be known that they were in this show, and they don't care what happens next.
Well, that was one of the real things. They talked about that, because apparently TNG was a really fun set. Everybody was joking around, and especially after they got past some of the tension of the first season. I mean, they're just more relaxed around one another. They just had a great time. And then you talk to the DS9 panel, which, of course, was huge. A huge number of people. They split it into two panels, and they talk about what was happening on their set, and they're like, yeah, no, it was a very serious set. It was just a much darker kind of environment, not with backbiting and everything, but just with how focused everybody was, and just because the show itself was so dark.
Yeah, because the cast was just as good, the show was just as good, and it was, as successful, it was not unsuccessful by any stretch.
No, it was just very intense, and I think it was more content driven, and that was even reflected in the questions that people were asking in the Q&A, where the questions they're asking the TNG folks were just a little bit lighter, and then the questions were that they were asking the DS9 folks. I mean, there was one woman who came up to ask her question and talked about, you know, how her fiance had committed suicide and she had been having suicidal thoughts, and DS9, you know, was her outlet and actually saved her life and all these things. And it's just, man, it was intense. And it was really interesting to see how just the intensity of the show was mirrored in the intensity that the cast had while performing in it. And, you know, to the intensity of the connection the audience has with that show. I mean, DS9 is a show that, you know, people tend to either, if they've watched it, they either love it or they hate it. There's very little middle ground. You can't just sort of, well, jump in here and there and take it or leave it. Oh, that was pretty good, like you can with TNG. And so that was really interesting to see that. There was some other really cool stuff happening on stage. One of the, you know, of course, they, you know, Marina and Brent and Jonathan were talking about their things and what's going on, and they're talking about the relationship of their characters and how the audience responds to Data versus responded to everybody else. And somebody mentioned that they love Brent's character, and it was Marina and Jonathan instantly just in that that same voice we were accustomed to hearing from sitcoms just chime in, "Everybody loves Data." But then they're getting towards the end of their session, and they're thinking they're going to go a little bit longer. They're like, "Well, who's up next?" And somebody's like, "Well, it's Kate Mulgrew and William Shatner." "Oh, the captains, we got to get off the stage." And then we got to see William Shatner and Kate Mulgrew take the stage.
Now, that's interesting because we were just talking about The Captains, which is on Netflix.
Right.
And their interview, now, I've seen the whole movie. Their interview is fairly tense. They're on a Broadway stage, and at any moment, Kate Mulgrew looks like she's going to punch Shatner right in the face. Well, and I haven't seen their full episode yet, because now he's broken the movie into five separate episodes. So I don't know if it got easier or if it got much worse.
Well, I don't know. I'm looking forward to seeing those. But on stage, I don't think there was anybody else who could have shared a stage with William Shatner.
Maybe Patrick Stewart.
Patrick Stewart could not have shared a stage with William Shatner in the same way. Because Kate is able to handle Shatner. I mean, in a way that they've got this dynamic, but he will listen to her and she will call him out while having this respect for what he does and listen to him, but in a way of not letting him run away with things and a way of keeping his ego in check. It's really an amazing dynamic to watch the two of them together. I could just watch those two chatting, you know, and it didn't have the sort of the conflict, the battle between egos that you might expect otherwise, and that you saw a lot in Shatner's raw nerve when he had that on the Biography Channel. But it's like he found his equal in the show.
Maybe on The Captains that's the battle, and maybe she won, and he knows it.
They've come to a resolution and are able and are working together on set. But you know that was really fascinating to see. I mean,
And if you want to see Kate Mulgrew be tough, you have to start watching Orange Is the New Black.
Yeah. So I've heard, you know, everybody seems to love that. She talked a lot about that, about Orange Is the New Black and how much she loves playing that character. And it is
such
a treat for her.
It's such a different role for her, because as tough as Janeway was, this is like she is decidedly middle-aged in Orange Is the New Black. And when I first saw her, even after seeing The Captains, I went, oh yeah, Voyager ended 12 years ago,
yeah.
Yeah, so like, it's a difference between 40 and 55.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and she's decidedly thick and middle-aged, and she's doing a heavy Russian accent. And she goes from being the scariest character in the first couple of episodes to somewhat sympathetic as you learn her backstory. But she's probably the only person that I really recognize in that show. Natasha Lyonne is also in it.
Okay.
But everybody else is fairly unknown. They shoot it in New York. So I'm guessing a lot of theater people. Jason Biggs is also in it, but a smaller role. But Kate Mulgrew just owns the screen in a way that even Janeway didn't.
Okay.
So
Well, you know, I think that's probably reflected a lot in just Kate being who she is, because she also did another two-person appearance on stage, where she appeared the next day with Robert Beltran.
Interesting, because Voyager, I just listened to Jeri Ryan was on Aisha Tyler's podcast.
Oh, Aisha Tyler has a podcast now?
Yes.
Oh, I have to say.
I think it's called Girl on Guy, and she usually talks to guys. She's had like Nathan Fillion on, and she's had David Tell, but she had Jeri Ryan on, and Jeri Ryan was pretty open about how stressful the Voyager set was, because it was interesting, because as you were saying how Deep Space Nine was a much more serious set than Next Generation, I was thinking about that podcast and I was like, yeah, and Voyager was an unhappy set. So it seems with each show they just had more stress, and then Enterprise.
Well, you know, and that's interesting, because when they were at the convention, the Voyager cast actually was ended up being one of the tightest casts.
Really?
Now at the end of the show, they had built a real more of a family connection on the set. Now I think, you know, even Jerry had commented on that in her talk, but I think hers was impacted by coming in halfway through the series.
Right. She talked about that, how there was a lot of jealousy that not only had she come in halfway through, but they had designed her character to steal the spotlight.
Mm-hmm.
And several cast members, and she doesn't mention by name, but she's obviously talking about Kate Mulgrew, was not happy about being the lead of a show and now playing second fiddle to a brand new character.
Mm.
So, and I remember at the time when Voyager was on, that Robert Beltran was pretty vocal towards the last few seasons, mm-hmm. about not wanting to be on.
Mm-hmm.
So I would love to hear what they have to say now. I mean, being more than 10 years out of it.
Right. You know, and it certainly seemed like they had, you know, and maybe that's a lot of what happens too. You know, they certainly, I mean, the TNG cast, they seemed like they were just, you know, almost like you just great drinking buddies that loved that, did a great job, had a lot of fun hanging out. You know, the DS9, all business. And it almost sounds like, you know, Voyager may have had more of a family dynamic then, with all of the tensions that come from but still being very tight and being very tightly having tight bonds within the cast.
Yeah, that's interesting. I would like to hear more about Enterprise, just to keep that analogy going, because with Enterprise, all I really know about is that everyone loves Scott Bakula, and Scott Bakula is a guy who has been on television sets for all of his adult life, and they mm-hmm. and the only stories I've really heard about Enterprise is when it started. You know, he was the guy who had done Quantum Leap. He knew how it ran, and he was like, "Look, this is how we all get along," and everybody followed his lead. But I don't really know too much about how everybody else worked.
Right. That's the thing about the Enterprise cast too. And this is one of those things of just watching it over time, watching the different casts as they appear on stage. We didn't really see any, I don't think I caught any broad Enterprise cast panels, but we did. Linda Park was there. Mm-hmm. And she spoke, I'm blanking on the actor's name now, who played Malcolm. And it was interesting to see them take the stage, because each of them took the stage in a very different way than, you know, cast from Voyager did, or from TNG, or from TOS, in that there's definitely a slight awkwardness to it, where they're just not as comfortable with, you know, the dynamic of the process of how it goes. Whereas when you see a Jerry Ryan or John Delancey takes the stage, and they're like, "Oh, I'm here. Let's have some questions."
Now, do you think that's because Enterprise is the youngest, so they haven't had as much time for it to settle in, or is it because Enterprise was canceled after 4 years?
I think it's exactly because it is so. It is the youngest, and they just haven't built up as broad a fan base, because Enterprise has never really made it into syndication,
right? There's less episodes. Number one,
yeah, and they're younger actors. Well, there's still more episodes than in TOS.
True,
they're younger actors, and they haven't spent 10, 15 years on the convention circuit. And I think that not to say they did a bad job or anything like that, but that certainly has an impact on just, you know, their style and their comfort level with being in that. Because, I mean, they're still in the heart of their acting careers and pursuing other things and still trying to make stars of themselves, mm-hmm. in a way that some of the others haven't, or have 20, 30 years of acting under your belt. And I think that has an impact on what you're doing there. I mean, the idea that, you know, just starting this role and all of this. I mean, the other thing that's amazing about this convention is the number of actors who have appeared in like one episode in one of the series and they're doing the convention circuit, and they're selling autographs, and they're doing presentations. The keynote celebrity, or the one who was the very first one after the welcome to the convention to take the main stage, was the guy who played Khan's son, Judson Scott.
Yeah, it's really like it's Sam Rockwell in Galaxy Quest.
Here's the thing. If you can get on, regardless of the next episode, a next series of Star Trek or what they do, just get yourself cast in Star Trek for one episode and you've got a retirement plan.
Yeah, there really is nothing quite like Star Trek. I feel like even Doctor Who now, or Buffy, you're not going to make a living doing the conventions.
No, you're not. Not for one episode.
Yeah.
So that's certainly really interesting element to see coming out of this. Oh, by the way, if you get a chance to listen to Alexander Setig talk, do it. he was better known for playing Dr. Bashir, and he gave some great talks.
Yeah.
And he's talking about his relationship with Cole Meany and his character's relationship with some of the others. And so it was really fascinating. It was really great to see that.
And you see him working a lot now just because he plays a lot of Arabic villains now. In the post 9/11 world, Alexander Siddig is very hireable.
Right.
I believe he's in Syriana. I just saw him in something else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also interesting about Deep Space Nine, because when I think about that cast, how you're saying they're all business. Mm-hmm. That was probably the most seasoned cast of everyone. Between Avery Brooks, Cole Meany, and Rene Auberjonois, just those guys, you have decades. And Armin Shimerman and Origin on Brooklyn Bridge. You have decades of television experience of them probably thinking, well, this is just my job until the next job. So they didn't see themselves catapulted the way. I mean, Next Generation, you know, you had Will Wheaton who had done Stand By Me, and you had LeVar Burton who had done Roots and Reading Rainbow, but everybody else was fairly unknown.
Well, and at this point, remember, when they were casting DS9, TNG was only in its third season.
Yeah. I think by the time it aired, it's like four or five, but they ran together for a while. It was TNG was a big enough hit to say, let's spin this off.
Right, exactly. Exactly. The other thing, when you're talking about the DS9 panel, at one point they got into a discussion with Armin Shimerman. I mean, just the nature of the discussion. Armin Shimerman gets into a discussion about how Quark is the most human of the characters in the Star Trek universe, which leads into a broader philosophical discussion about the nature of humanity and the needs of the different characters. And it's like, it's like getting into a philosophy seminar here. Mm. And you know, which was very different from some of the other discussions, like the Jerry Ryan one, where one of the guys in the audience comes up to ask the question and asks her to basically, he says he bought a what was supposed to be a 7 of 9 costume at auction for $5,000, and he wanted to see if she recognized it. And he pulled it out of this bag, and she brings it up on stage and looks at it, and she authentic. She's like, "Yeah, this looks like this was one of mine."
It's interesting. It's interesting to see what people focus on from shows. I was watching this San Diego. I was lucky enough. They put the entire panel on YouTube, but they had the 20th anniversary of the X-Files, and David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson were there, and Chris Carter was there, and Vince Gilligan, and they're talking about they start talking about how they really created a genre, and they were the only show doing vampires and zombies at the time. They were the only show doing long story arcs and building themselves around mysteries, and how influential they were. And all people wanted to talk about was the relationship of Mulder and Scully. Like, right. Even now when they had a child and they were living together in the second movie, that's all the questions. And it's interesting how fans tend to grapple on one topic. So yeah, Voyager had lots of different stories and lots of different characters, but people are gonna just ask what Jerry Ryan squeezed her body into.
Yeah, exactly. Although at one point during one of the other questioners of during the Belter and Mulgrew panel, one of the other questioners came up and Kate identified him as her stalker immediately. And who asked, and of course it was one Mr. Garrett Wong. Who was like, you know, Ms. Mulgrew, can you tell me why after 7 years I was never promoted?
Because you're at the other side of the universe. Nobody was promoted on that show.
But yes, I mean, that was really awesome. One of the other really cool things that was happening there was, you know, outside of the vendor room where we acquired multiple tribbles, multiple t-shirts, various pins and badges, and even a Resican flute, there was also auctions happening. So they were actually doing live auctions there. So they were doing auctioning off just random memorabilia. At one point, I actually won an auction for a sweatshirt, autographed, a bunch of tote bags, an autographed picture of Jimmy Doohan, and a bunch of other stuff. And then there was another spontaneous auction happening in the middle of that, where the auction was interrupted by Gates McFadden, who has her own theater group in Southern California, and she's raising money for it by just auctioning off stuff from her storage unit.
Okay.
And that is how I came to buy the fanny pack off of Gates McFadden's hips.
And how much did you pay for the fanny pack?
$125.
That sounds fair.
It was one of the cast Christmas presents that Gene Roddenberry gave out to all the members of the cast after season one.
Back when fanny packs were fashionable.
Yes, leather embroidered fanny packs. It was really a complete product of the time.
Not exactly of the future.
It was just so silly, and it was like one of those just really, it was just really cool in the moment.
Now, were you outbid, or did you stand up and say $125 for Gates fanny pack?
Well, somebody was like, the current bid was $100. I raised my hand for $125, and I won.
So that was as far as the auction went.
That was as far as that one went.
There was no fighting for it. You were willing to counter offer an end of auction.
Yeah, well, that was as high as it went. That's how auctions work. And there was a signed gold Enterprise, which went for about $800. Wow. She was also auctioning off the invitation for Jack and Beverly's wedding that appeared briefly in Nemesis.
Huh.
That went for like $200.
No, I don't even remember that.
Yeah, there were a couple of things. She brought a few things up, so she's actually doing a lot of that. She's actually has her own, does a lot of auctions on eBay now of just various memorabilia and other things. There was a script, one of her scripts from an episode, signed by a whole bunch of folks. One of her working scripts, which actually had her notes in it, she auctioned that off. I don't even remember how much that went, but that went for a few hundred bucks.
Every time I see Gates McFadden, I want her to talk about the Muppets. Because, you know, she worked for Henson right before Next Generation. She's in Labyrinth.
That's right. She's a choreographer.
Yeah, and I think she was actually a Muppeteer. I think she's working some of the puppets in that. But she's on the DVD. If you watch the making of Labyrinth, she pops up as Cheryl McFadden.
Yep.
And it's Labyrinth comes out about the same year as season one. And I've always wanted to know, how do you go from the Muppets to Star Trek?
Well, if you go through effects, it's probably not all that different.
I guess so.
But here's what's really cool, and this is a real testament to Gates McFadden's acting ability, is that in series, she is always one of the most evenly paced, plotting characters. Her speech is slow, deliberate, with the requisite passion when called for. But when you see her in person, she is positively manic. She's bouncing off the walls. and it's just seeing her, whether on stage or just chatting with her, she is just so far removed from Beverly Crusher. It's pretty amazing.
Yes, that's a true character. I was just watching the Blu-rays for season four. And I was noticing that she's putting on like a bit of an accent. Like, it's half New England and half British.
Mm-hmm.
And it is very mannered. I mean, the show is mannered. You know, you watch
sure.
you watch it now, 25 years later, you see there is a style that is going across that show that mm-hmm. was not used on any other show.
Right.
You know, so it's certainly not naturalistic in any way at all.
Right.
But yeah.
But you know, it's interesting because some of them, you know, you can see it, you can see a lot more Picard in Patrick Stewart and a lot more Riker in Jonathan Frakes than you can see Crusher in Gates McFadden.
Yeah, and I think we don't see Marina Sirtis in Troy until the movies.
Right, right. Yeah, until she gets drunk with Zefram Cochrane.
That is the greatest Troy moment. And after that, she totally loosens up because the next two movies, she's just like, her accent gets British. It stops being Middle Eastern.
Yeah, so I mean, that was really, really interesting. The other thing that was really interesting was we got to see Nichelle appear on stage.
Okay, now Nichelle Nichols was the first celebrity I ever saw at my first convention in mm-hmm. 1986. She came out to preview some still shots of Star Trek IV in a ballroom.
Oh, wow.
And that was a big deal. These were the days, you know, you didn't bring a trailer. She had a slideshow presentation.
Literal slides.
Yeah, and she took questions, and the room was like, it was like a small side conference room, and it was standing room only. And it was mm-hmm. the first celebrity I had ever seen and saw speak. And now it's about 30 years later. So what was your experience like?
My experience was complicated. And here's why. I think if you can see Nichelle Nichols this year, do it. Because I think she's probably about ready for retirement. To begin with, her presentation, when she came out, the guy, basically the guy who runs Creation, was interviewing her. He spent the first several minutes talking to, obviously, this icon of feminism and of racial integration and spends the first several minutes talking to her about her fashion and jewelry, which seemed a little inappropriate. But as the interview goes on, it was almost as though, I don't know if she was having trouble hearing people or she's having trouble processing some of the questions, because she wasn't as sharp as it would have hoped or as I've come to expect from some of the other books. And the host had to sort of keep her on track from time to time. So I don't know if this is the kind of environment or presentation we'll see her doing much more. I mean, you know, it's TOS cast. They're in their 80s now.
Right. Yeah, but you never know. I mean,
you never know. And I went and I got her autograph afterwards mm-hmm. Through the signing line. And, you know, I mean, she was, you know, sharp and chatting with folks, but it was just a very awkward and, you know, you felt in one of those interviews you feel slightly uncomfortable at. Mm. Like when you're seeing, it's not that she was like, You know, you see this sometimes with live comedy where you see somebody bombing, and you just know that you're just sort of a little cringy.
Yeah,
she wasn't bombing by any means, but at a point it felt a little like it felt a little bad for her up there.
Like yeah, it went off the rails a little too often.
Yeah,
but you know, age doesn't have that much to do with it, because when I worked at the Museum yep. of Television and Radio, we had Lauren Bacall come in, and she was about 90.
Mm-hmm.
And, sharp. Like, she was cutting people down in the audience for asking long questions.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, when Shatner was up on the stage, or Takei, you know, and they were all about the same age.
Yeah.
You know, they were
Well, they're
fine.
At the point now where everyone who is older than them in the cast yeah. has passed away.
Yeah.
James Doohan and DeForest Kelly were the oldest.
Yes, exactly. So I don't know if Nichelle will continue doing those types of things, or maybe it was just an off night or what. But you know, I've read her book, and she's had such an amazing career, and the things that she has done. It's just really, really impressive, you know. And then, you know, just getting to chat with her just for a moment, you know, as I got a copy of my book signed. Oh, it's just more, you know, I really enjoyed your work. And she's like, oh, did you read the book? And this is one of the things when I, you know, having met a couple of the cast members at the time, having, you know, and meeting Walter Koenig at a previous convention, George, I'll come back to George Takei in just a moment, at this one, they always really surprised when I you know, or with Gary Graham even, you know, where I bring in a copy of their book to get them to sign it. And they're like, you actually read my book?
Well, what's the percentage of people at signings that have read the book?
Probably it's pretty low. People will find it for a dollar in the discount bin and just bring it. I don't.
Yeah, especially if they're so surprised.
And then you start mention something you read in the book, and they're like, "Wow, that's wow."
It's like when people repeat a joke that I told on a podcast. I don't expect anyone paying attention.
Exactly.
But yeah, I always feel bad with the autobiography because we are taught to believe that once you have written down your story, it is immortal and it is there for the ages.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I wrote a book. This book exists now. And it's, you know, like it's in the Library of Congress and it will never go away. And no one's read it. And a year later, it's in a discount bin and it's recycled. It's as print is as temporary as anything else.
Well, yeah, except it's not going to go away entirely. Although I'm sure there are thousands of books in libraries that have never been read.
That's what I mean.
Yeah. But it's there. And it is a mark on society that will last for centuries, more than most things that are digital, until we figure out how to preserve our digital stuff better. But I think that's a whole separate challenge.
Yeah. Well, right now the solution we have is to just keep transferring our digital content to the next thing, and then to the next thing, and that because the files are fine. It's everything that we put it on will die.
Well, and the files are not fine either because the files have to be translated. How many people today can easily open a WordStar file?
Right. Yeah. Well, that's the idea. It's all the idea of language. It's the way the computer is reading a program in the way that we're reading. Because you could take that to its logical conclusion and say, well, in 500 years, we might not speak English anymore.
Right.
And then and then we won't have a way to read this in the same way that if Adobe Acrobat completely disappears and we don't have a way to open the file.
But the difference is we can still read what was written 500 years ago.
Yeah, if we know the language.
Well, we do today. We can access stuff written 500 years ago. The language hasn't changed that completely.
Yeah, that's true.
We haven't lost Shakespeare.
That's true.
We haven't even lost.
But you know how much have we lost from Shakespeare's time?
Well, I think when we start looking at that, you start looking at there was a premium placed on preserving your content because it wasn't easy to just create content and put it on paper. Only a few people were able to do that. So the stuff most likely to be preserved was going to be the most important. What we've lost is the shopping lists and the to-do lists and a lot of that stuff. Although now we're coming up with, you know, clay tablets from the Mesopotamian era, you know, of like just normal business transactions and some of that stuff surviving on clay and things like that. So I think, you know, the content that's really been recognized.
That would be really bad if that guy was embezzling.
Yes, it would. Yes, it would.
5,000 years later, there's no statute of limitations on this.
Somebody ignored
the document. You took four goose from me and you only wrote down three, you bastard.
Somebody ignored the document retention policy. The lawyers are going to be really upset. but yeah, you know, it's and yeah, so that's an interesting challenge about what are we filtering, what are we preserving, what are we not, versus what are we able to process.
Right. Right, and you know, every time the new technology comes on, there's always stuff that drops off. You know, you think of a film that never made it to VHS, which then never made it to DVD, which never made it to Blu-ray.
Right.
You know, which will never be on streaming.
And is now sort of slowly decaying in a film canister in a salt mine archive under Missouri.
Right. Yeah. Because there's no humidity there.
Exactly. You know, at one point, will we have lost all evidence of of just that random violent assassination in that bar, that unprovoked assault where Han just kills Greedo.
I was about to say, did someone hit you? But the thing I'm saying is that we are going to keep migrating our digital data
right.
better and better, which means you'll always be able to read your tweets. That's the most important thing in human psychology. What did I eat? In 140 characters, let me tell you what we ate in the 21st century.
Well, let me tell you, that is going to be some of the most valuable sociological and anthropological evidence we have 200 years from now. Where Twitter and the preservation of these 140 character tweets is going to give the future generations a better picture of normal, banal, day-to-day life that we have here in 2013 than we have going back a couple hundred years. Because as I was saying before, when it's the stuff that's only the most important stuff that gets preserved, you get a much more filtered version of life in the 16 and 1700s just by the nature of people had to be careful about what they preserve. Now, when you can preserve everything and talk about everything, yes, Twitter and Facebook, it's still a curated version of ourselves, but it's definitely a broader and more accurate picture of ourselves than we've ever had before. Oh, and by the way, the other thing that I've been thinking about a lot lately is this whole idea of food pictures in Twitter and Facebook and everybody posting their meals.
I hate that so much.
Here's why you're wrong.
Because someday we're going to run out of food and we're going to try to have to remind ourselves of a time where we had food to eat before overpopulation and climate change destroyed our resources.
No. It's because sharing a meal is so fundamental to the human experience. Going back decades, centuries, millennia, you look at the core ritual of the Catholic faith is about sharing a meal. The whole idea of the Holy Communion there, that's central to ourselves as people. You look at what we celebrate the most, in our country today. It's Thanksgiving. It's the Christmas dinner. It's all of these opportunities to bring people around, to gather around a meal. You see this in Tolkien, where you're gathering around the fire with different characters to share a meal, despite the whole elevensies things that other people don't do. You know, that whole idea of sharing a meal and sharing food with family and friends and, brokering deals and business meetings over business dinners and lunches and things like that. That is sort of what binds us as people. And what happens now, we've started to see this trend as more and more people are moving more to Facebook and Twitter and things like that. This whole idea of posting a picture of your food is really sort of a modern digital analog of sharing a meal. Yeah, you're not sitting down across the table with somebody, but you have that connection with your friends and your colleagues of sharing food. It's so deep in us that that's why we feel compelled to share those things on social media. It's not just about, hey, here's something you're not eating. It's like, it's about connecting with people by having that meal, by having that cupcake. And besides, some of this stuff just looks too awesome to not take a picture of.
But why does the caption have to be yum?
Because you have to put in a caption and some people aren't that creative.
and that is the platform where we both have met.
So primal that we don't necessarily know why we're doing it.
No, nobody knows why they're doing it. I know why I'm not. I know precisely why.
That's because you don't like to eat.
I don't like to eat.
You don't like to eat and you don't like people. There's a connection there.
Yeah. I like to drink. I'll drink anything. I like it all. Coffee, water, Gatorade, booze. I don't care. I like science food. I had a friend of mine who I was getting baked potato chips, and he goes, "You can't eat those." And I'm like, "What do you mean I can't eat them? It's like 6% fat. They're great for you." And he goes, "You don't understand. In a factory, they just mix up this potato batter, and then they pour it out onto the conveyor belt and chop it up. And it's not real potatoes. They just pour this goo out, and you're eating dried potato goo." And I went, "And your problem?" I like science food. I was very excited by freeze-dried ice cream the first time I heard about that. It's like ice cream that doesn't have to go in the freezer? That solves all my problems. I don't need to see a plate where beans are touching eggs.
Well, and now we've got our resident genius. I mean, one of the cool things about living in the age we do is that we live in the age populated by people like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and Sergey Brin, who is now funding the development of beef. Test tube beef.
I'm okay with that.
Factory beef, exactly. So the guy behind a lot of the stuff at Google and the self-driving cars and all this stuff is now they're
he's going to make self-eating food.
They're building beef.
Make it.
This is cool.
Yeah, it'll be self-eating food. I don't even have to be involved.
You don't have to be
involved
at all.
It's food that will eat itself and then wash its own dishes, and I can be in the other room. Binge watching a television series.
and you know what this makes possible? Once you can manufacture your beef, now you can start copying it or replicating it and building it up from energy and matter and having it just in a bin there. And from beef, it's not that far until we get to Earl Grey tea.
Well, that's also where the 3D printer comes in.
Exactly.
That's where we're living. Okay, we are totally off topic. But you know, we're at...
Okay, so let me tell
you. You know what? We are at 45 minutes. So this is going to be a whole podcast.
Okay. You know, obviously, in addition, we got a lot of autographs done. We got to get autographs from the entire TNG cast for this jacket the girlfriend has, which was awesome to complete that.
Yeah. So you're done because we talked about this at Emerald City, about the Patrick Stewart.
Yes.
You got everybody?
Yes, we did. You know, Patrick Stewart and Will Wheaton were the first. Then we got, we got Gates and Jonathan and Michael and LeVar, John DeLancey, Marina.
Oh, so you're counting John DeLancey.
We're counting John DeLancey because, he was there. and really, John DeLancey's character, Q, he drives every major story arc in TNG.
He's in
nine
episodes every season.
Total.
Yeah, two in the first season.
Mm-hmm. You know, and everything, all the major stuff that happens, it's because of Q.
Yeah. There was a lot of talk about Q being one of the movies, and it never came to be.
Yeah. Yeah. But the greatest thing was George Takei. Because George Takei is awesome by himself.
He is a cultural icon.
He is. He is. And he gets up and he gave his presentation. Then I went and waited for his autograph. And while I'm waiting in line for his autograph, it's taking a long time because George likes to chat. So his husband actually comes out and starts chatting with everybody and greeting them. So we got to chat with him. And then I go up and I get my book signed by George. And he asked me, I said, did you read the book? I'm like, well, yes, I did. I really appreciated it. I really liked your discussion.
No, wait, no. He said, did you read the book? Yeah, you got to say it the way he said it. Did you like the book?
Well, the thing is, and then we start talking about it. I'm like, I really liked how you approached the whole internment story. Because in his book, he talked, what many people don't realize is that George Takei spent several years of his young life in a prison camp in Arkansas for the crime of his, parents having been born in Japan.
During World War II.
Yeah, exactly. And so he tells this story of this, it's one of the darker periods of American history, but he does it in such a way that it's all just very matter of fact. He's not beating a drum about how horrible it was, just telling the story. And I think that makes it more powerful. But then, so I mentioned that, and he's like, yes, that's what I wanted to do. But we're talking about, and he's talking about how it's a dark history and how, how much he loves this country. And how important it is, and how his father is his hero for continuing to love this country and what it stands for. Because America withstanding for freedoms and for liberties in a way that you're not going to find in most other places in the world. That we don't always live up to our goals, but they're there, and we do a very good job of it most of the time. And just the sort of the love of country and the passion for being able to talk about that it's just really awesome to hear that. And what's also awesome is just that in this line of several hundred people, that George Takei is the kind of guy who will take the time to not only personalize an autograph, but to have that conversation with you that goes quickly into, you know, concepts of heroism and values and democracy and what we're able to stand for. And that is one of the greatest things about the show.
That's awesome. So would you go back?
That is an excellent question we're trying to figure out right now. I don't know if I need to go back to this convention again. I got my mission accomplished of getting most of the key autographs I wanted. There was some really interesting stuff. One of the really cool things was just everybody in all these different costumes and the uniforms across all episodes of the series. You know, obviously, people just with real uniforms. I'm like, if I go back, I have to have a uniform first. You know, there was about a 10% chance I was going to leave this conference with Starfleet tech.
Now, what uniform would you get?
You see, that's what's holding me up. Uh-huh. You know, I would go with the Enterprise uniform, but it looks like it's really hot.
It looks like it could be
really complicated if you have to go to the bathroom. But the Enterprise jumpsuit does make some sense. There were a bunch of people in classic movie uniforms. I'm like, my God, what the hell are you doing wearing that in Vegas? But so I would probably, I think if I had to choose right now, I'd probably go for movie uniform or Voyager.
I could see you in a movie uniform.
So the new movies, but yeah, or Voyager uniform. So I'd probably go that way. You know, it would be really awesome to go to the auctions again for all the different memorabilia, and there were some killer deals there, and there was a lot of really interesting things happening there and great presentations. The one thing it lacked that you don't get at a lot of the other, and you know, and there were some great musical performances there too. Tim Russ, I now have his CDs on order. He's awesome. Hearing his music, and they did a Rat Pack thing with, you know, a bunch of the folks from DS9. You know, again, awesome, and all this, but the whole thing, it was very much audience performer, audience stage. There wasn't the broader sense of community and interaction you get at some of the other events and some of the other
conventions. Not even in the dealer's room? Not even going to the booths and running into people?
Well, I mean, it seemed very much... Yeah, well, yeah, not even there. I mean, even there, everybody's friendly, make no mistake. But there's no real sense of, you know, we're all in this together. And maybe that's the scale of it. Maybe that's the size of it. And so I don't know. Or maybe I was just being particularly antisocial and didn't observe more of that. But that's something I've seen at other events with just this whole broader community feel to it that wasn't there. That said, and if you're a Star Trek fan, you need to go to this thing at least once in your life.
Yeah, the only other focused convention I ever went to was TARDIS Chicago last year, and that definitely had that we're all in this together feeling. Maybe Vegas is just too big. Maybe a smaller one in Seattle,
or maybe the Star Trek universe is just too big.
Maybe. One last question. How's the Star Trek restoration going?
It's going quite well. They had, you know, we got our pictures taken on the bridge. I was hoping to get a chance to talk to Huston, but I didn't actually talk to some of the other folks there. It was real popular, and but yeah, I got some pictures of me on the bridge. I got to send that into their restoration project. Of course, I got pictures of my little traveling penguin as the captain. And yeah, so it was awesome to see that. They actually did a couple had a vow renewal done with their minister, Denise Crosby. There was a Klingon wedding on the bridge. So it was getting a lot of use in a lot of lines. And, you know, there were people collecting some donations. And, you know, all these folks, here's the thing. You line up to go sit in the chair. First of all, it is free. You know, they're not charging anything to take your picture in the chair. You're getting to sit in Patrick Stewart's chair. That's pretty cool. And the folks on that group, they're just some of the nicest folks I've dealt with, and they've got some nice souvenirs you can buy and shirts and stuff to help raise money, and it's definitely worthwhile. I mean, their lines, and they're not rushing. They weren't rushing people through. They're like, take your picture for you. They'll, you know, have a seat. Oh, do you want to sit? Yeah, you know, and they're. It was just really, really friendly, real love for the franchise, and not a mercenary sense to it at all.
So maybe
that's fantastic.
Maybe that's where your community feeling was.
That could be. That could be. I mean, they're doing something magic there. And so I, you know, after listening to that interview you did with them, I really hope they're able to succeed with their broader vision too, because, you know, I want to see the Enterprise Bridge next to a Colonial Viper, because that would be awesome.
Yeah. Well, I think if there's no better place to leave than when you've just had an epiphany. So, this was awesome. Tell everybody what's your Facebook handle? How can people get in touch with you, Bill?
They can find me. I'm on Facebook as simply Bill Monroe. They can follow me on Twitter at Cromley, Cromely. And they can follow my rarely updated blog at Cromely.net, Cromely.net.
The greatest thing in the world.
This week. I haven't been to a concert in about 3 years, but when I heard Black Sabbath was reuniting, I knew I had to go. I saw them in 1999. It was one of the best shows I've ever seen. And to be honest, I didn't expect very much from this. It's 14 years later, and Ozzy has become a caricature with the Osbournes, and Tony Iommi's been diagnosed with cancer, and Bill Ward wasn't even there. He couldn't work out contract negotiations with Sharon Osbourne. But I figured this was my last chance to go, so Joe Pakovitz and I went down and saw them in Tinley Park out here, and they were actually better than they were the first time. They played everything you wanted them to play, but they sounded phenomenal. And to be honest, when I saw them the first time, Ozzy was pretty drunk. He lost his voice on the third song, which was NIB. He mooned the audience. He ran around crazy. And he can't do that anymore. So he stood still most of the time. Actually, all of them stood still. There wasn't a lot of craziness. It was a small venue, not a huge stage show. But they played so well. Iommi, in particular, played better than I saw him. And he was always somebody who was pretty straight. And I figured with his illness, he would have been diminished. None of them were diminished. The drummer they brought on tour with them was fantastic. Was even into his drum solo. And here's a guy who's not an official member of Black Sabbath. We saw one of the very first dates, so they're touring right now. If you get a chance and they come to your city, definitely go. I think most of you should be interested at least to hear Iron Man, War Pigs, or Paranoid. The whole night's worth it. And the new album's great, too. It was produced by Rick Rubin, and I really enjoy it. I thought on first listen it sounded great, but I wasn't crazy about the material, and the songwriting has only grown on me each time I listen to it. So a little change of pace from the rest of the show, but perfect time to mention it. As always, you can follow me at Not In My Book. That is the Twitter handle for Caffeinated Comics. You can like us on Facebook as you listen to us on iTunes. Give us a rating and leave us a review. I'll be back with Steve next week, and we'll talk to you then.
Caffeinated Comics is a Not In My Book production.
Take that!